Back in the late 80s, a dedicated high school teacher in East Los Angeles inspired a hit movie. Stand and Deliver was the story of Jaime Escalante, who convinced his students they could do anything with a good education. Recently, Escalante's family revealed that he's dying of cancer and that he's run out of money. So now the teacher's many admirers are standing up and delivering for him. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
The light drizzle on a recent afternoon didn't dampen the enthusiasm of Garfield's cheerleaders. They shook their pom-poms on the street in front of Garfield High and encouraged passersby and drivers to drop donations in buckets held by students dressed as Bulldogs, their school's mascot. From the early 80s through 1991, Bolivian-born Jaime Escalante successfully taught calculus and other advanced math classes at Garfield to Latino kids who were routinely written off by society. Mark Baca says by teaching students like him the rigorous discipline,
he changed the minds of people all over the world about barrio kids. But we love Kimo because he was our mentor, he was our teacher, he was our friend, and he motivated us to believe in ourselves.
And the barrio kids who mastered algebra, geometry, trigonometry, and calculus under Escalante have come back to show their gratitude. Lawyer Araceli Lerma reels off a partial list of schools that accepted Escalante students from her 1991 graduating class.
My classmates, folks went to Harvard, Stanford, Dartmouth, MIT.
Escalante's story was immortalized in the motion picture Stand and Deliver. Edward James Olmos earned an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of Escalante, and the two have remained close ever since. Now Olmos is spearheading the effort to help his friend in the final stages of Escalante's illness. Olmos says it's the least they can do for the teacher his kids affectionately nicknamed Kimo, short for Kimo Sabe, he who knows.
To say thank you to someone while they're alive is the best way of communicating your love for them.
What Kimo did for his kids, Olmos says, is hard for people who don't come from here to fully appreciate.
He started off in a very small inner city school, showed the entire country that these kids that were from intensely difficult environments were capable of handling what he called a great equalizer, which was mathematics.
Math, Escalante believes, is the portal to understanding almost everything else. If you can figure out the patterns, the logic of math, you can do anything. Lawyer Sandra Munoz says Kimo ignored labels and classifications like gifted and honors.
The thing about Mr. Escalante is he didn't care whether or not you were designated in the gifted and talented program. He gave opportunities to everybody.
And as this clip from Stand and Deliver shows, he expected them to work for it, even when other kids got time off.
Saturdays? You gotta come on Saturdays? And no vacations?
Yep, pass the AP exam and you get college credit.
What it took was ganas, the desire, the will to do the work. In a comfortable house in the town of Whittier, classmates Dolores Arredondo and Alicia Barrera are leafing through their Garfield yearbook.
It's embarrassing, right? All that hair in the 80s.
Barrera reads Escalante's inscription.
Remember, you are the best. Love, Jaime, stand and deliver.
Barrera says that was Kimo's mantra to his students. Work hard, then work harder. You can do this because you are the best. Which doesn't mean it'll be simple, he told their class when he spoke at their 1991 graduation.
You must be ready to work harder than you ever worked before.
And once we went to college, math wasn't as hard. You know, most of the classes weren't as bad as, because they didn't require as much as what he had required from us.
Barrera's classmate, Dolores Arredondo, is a vice president at one of California's largest banks. She becomes visibly emotional about Escalante's legacy.
He brought so much pride to the school, to the neighborhood. He even, I think, elevated the standards that other teachers had for themselves.
She's eager to help the man who she says changed their lives.
That's why I think we all feel this sense of responsibility, not just to him, but to his family, because they shared him with us, and now we got to give back to them.
And they will. Escalante's former students have the ganas to see that their beloved mentor gets the support he needs. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The city of New York hands out 40 million condoms a year, and it had a problem. The wrapper on that condom was deemed a little boring. So the city held an online contest and today announced a new design winner. NPR's Robert Smith has the story.
New graphic design rule. Anything you put on the wrapper of a condom starts to look somehow erotic. Take, for instance, Russell Greenberg's submission, the image of a beaver pelt top hat right out of the 19th century.
It seemed like a simpler, more chivalrous time, so I wanted to kind of remind people of the fact that it was good manners involved in sex, and I thought the top hat was a good symbolic reference to that.
And if you picture your little gentleman wearing a jaunty chapeau, then so much the better. Other entries in the condom contest were even more suggestive. The image of a manhole, you know, the round metal ones in the street, a subway train plunging into a dark tunnel.
I didn't want it to be, like, in your face, you know?
We appreciate that, designer Gene Lambert. Everyone knows there's nothing dirtier than the New York City subway system. The finalists in the condom contest had gathered at New York's health department for the announcement of the winner. Tension was mounting in the room as Health Commissioner Thomas Farley introduced the climactic release.
The winning design, reveal it now.
It's the power on symbol that you would find on the power button of a computer or a stereo system. You know, that round circle with the little line thrusting up?
When I saw that, I said this was pure genius. Everyone recognizes that symbol on their PC. This sends a message that people should use their own power to control their sexual health.
Dr. Farley somehow missed the opportunity to make a joke about turning on New Yorkers, but he's a serious guy. What are you going to do? The strange thing is, once you stare at that power on symbol, it's now hard not to see it as sexual. The designer, Louis Acosta, says that's the idea.
I wanted to associate it with something that we see in our daily lives so that, you know, it's not so taboo for people.
Had you always looked at a power symbol and thought, that kind of looks like intercourse?
You know, I really like electronics. I don't think I like them that much, though.
Acosta's new sex symbol will not be on all New York City condoms, just a limited release, but it will probably be one of the most recognized logos in New York.
I think it's 6 million.
6 million?
6 million condoms. So I get to be part of, you know, about maybe 4 million people's sex lives.
You figure you use them a few times, right?
Yeah, exactly, multiples. Louis Acosta will not be among those 4 million happy, happy souls. He's married and says he doesn't use condoms anymore. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For more than a year, we've been sitting down with Americans around the kitchen table to talk about one thing, money, and how they're making ends meet in this tough economy. Today, we focus on higher education, specifically the cost of medical school. Many doctors graduate tens of thousands, some hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. NPR's Claudio Sanchez heard from one family, and they are hopping mad.
This story begins with an email from Jane Rosen of Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Dear Mr. Sanchez, I'm writing as a parent with one child in medical school and another set to go to law school.
Not long after Jane Rosen's daughter, Sarah, took out a couple of federally backed loans to help pay for her medical school tuition, the interest on those loans shot up to 8.5%, almost twice the rate the Rosens are paying after refinancing their mortgage. It made Jane's blood boil. Her email goes on.
Why is the Department of Education charging these young borrowers far more than banks and the Federal Reserve Bank charge their customers, so that the cost of higher education is even more prohibitive than it needs to be?
Rosen says there's no reason the government can't simply cut the interest rates on graduate and professional student loans in half and give families a break, just like the Federal Reserve stepped in and gave big banks a break. Rosen says the U.S. Education Department can do the same.
That would be a decision that Congress could make, but
it won't, says Bob Shireman, Deputy Undersecretary of Education, because nobody is lobbying Congress to cut student loan interest rates. And as far as the Obama administration is concerned, well, reducing those rates is not nearly as important as expanding financial aid for undergraduate low-income students. That's the administration's priority. Besides, says Shireman, the 8.5% interest the Rosens are paying is reasonable.
I mean, if you try to get a student loan that's not backed by the federal government, the rate's going to be 15, 18, 20-something percent. So from a market perspective, it's not a high interest rate.
Tell that to Jane Rosen's daughter, Sarah, who will have borrowed $300,000 by the time she finishes medical school. This year, Sarah is paying $69,000 at Boston University.
I've had to borrow all of it.
Sarah and two friends have agreed to meet on a frigid Saturday morning at Boston Medical Center, BU's teaching hospital.
Okay, we're waiting in the East Newton lobby. Hi! How are you?
They want to talk about the financial pressure they're under. Sarah says she could have gone to a cheaper public medical school back home in New Jersey, but tuition there was not much lower. Tuition and fees at public medical schools, after all, have shot up 133% since 1990, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. So what will your monthly payments look like after you graduate and begin your residency, I asked Sarah.
I haven't figured it out, and to be honest, I don't know if I want to.
Sarah's friend Natalie Wittig, a first-year medical student from Chicago, guesses that she'll be paying up to $1,500 a month and says she doesn't know anyone who isn't stressed out about paying back their loans.
Of course, you're mortgaging your brain. I think most medical students realize that.
In survey after survey, the American Medical Students Association has found that the stress that comes from owing so much money absolutely influences students' decisions about what branch of medicine to pursue.
Like right now, primary care, there aren't many physicians going into primary care because there's just no money there.
Nicole Beaton, for example, also a first-year medical student from Miami, wants to be a family doctor but doesn't know if she can afford to because she's borrowing 100% of the money she needs to pay for medical school.
In order to, you know, pay these loans, you have to specialize and subspecialize and find that one little niche where you can really make the money to be able to pay these loans and to make a living for yourself.
Roughly 9 in 10 doctors graduate deeply in debt. The average loan burden, over $150,000.
Actually, that infuriates me.
Sitting across a tiny kitchen table in her daughter's studio apartment, Jane Rosen says her daughter Sarah, like most young people who go into medicine, just want to give back.
They did not go into it with their eyes closed. You know, they're young. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of optimism that they'll be able to repay their debt.
But students are borrowing tons of money with no protection whatsoever, says Rosen. Truth in lending requirements don't apply to federal student loans. They're not subject to bankruptcy protection. The government can take a person's wages and tax refunds if a student defaults. And there's no statute of limitations. That's all true, but education department officials point out that under current law, medical students who owe hundreds of thousands of dollars don't have to pay more than 15% of their income. President Obama wants to lower that to 10%. As for the 8.5% interest rate that so upsets parents and students who've taken out government-backed loans, that is here to stay. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
American composer Samuel Barber would have been 100 years old today. Barber was a favorite with musicians and audiences, but his music didn't fare as well with critics. They tended to write it off as merely pretty. But in the decades since Barber's death, that opinion has begun to change. From Philadelphia, Joel Rose reports.
Samuel Barber's music has gone way beyond the concert hall. Barber's Adagio for Strings swells up in dozens of films. It's been played at Ground Zero in New York and at official state funerals. It's become, in a way, our national music of mourning.
Everybody knows the Adagio, even if they don't know the name of it or who wrote it. They recognize it as soon as they hear it as this elegiac, wonderful piece of music.
Barbara Heyman wrote a biography of Samuel Barber. He grew up in Westchester, Pennsylvania. When he was 9, he wrote a letter to his mother asking her not to make him play football. Barber had other plans, as he said in a 1978 interview.
I was 7 years old when I began composing. I began composing improvising at the piano, the usual story. I was supposed to be a doctor. I was supposed to go to Princeton. Everything I was supposed to do, I didn't.
Instead, Barber went to the brand new Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. He was just 28 years old when Arturo Toscanini's NBC Orchestra gave the first performance of the Adagio for Strings. While the piece made Barber famous, it also cast a long shadow over the rest of his career. Johanna Keller is a professor of journalism at Syracuse University, who's working on her own book about Barber.
I think Barber had his problems with the fact that the Adagio became so popular. It seemed to eclipse some of his other works.
Barber was not a prolific composer. He published only one symphony, two operas, and a handful of sonatas and concertos. Barber carefully tailored his work to the strengths of the musicians who would play it, and Johanna Keller says those musicians loved him for it.
They understood its quality, they understood how well it worked for the instruments and for voices. Critics, not so much.
In particular, critic and composer Virgil Thompson. He dismissed Barber as a composer for, quote, high middlebrow taste. And Barber's music does sound conservative next to the atonal modernist style in vogue in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. If the scathing reviews bothered Barber, he tried not to show it. Here he is talking to Robert Sherman on WQXR in New York in 1978.
To what extent did you take the words of critics to heart?
Very little. I once learned that the best thing to do with about criticisms was to pay no attention to them, but to measure them.
Measure them, meaning what?
No, measure how long they were.
Oh, I see. So the longer they are, the more important
of course.
The source. I see.
Yeah. I've told that to many young composers, and nobody ever listened.
It's an approach that worked well for Barber early in his career, as he produced a string of works that are still widely performed, including Knoxville Summer of 1915 for soprano and orchestra.
It has become the time of evening when people sit on their porches, rocking gently and talking gently.
But Barber's reputation took a major hit in 1966 at the opening of the new Metropolitan Opera House. Biographer Barbara Heyman says the first performance of his opera, Antony and Cleopatra, was a disaster.
The production had all this paraphernalia that was going on, including something like 60 animals on stage and, you know, tremendous cast, so noisy that you couldn't hear the music in some instances.
Antony and Cleopatra wasn't Barber's only setback. It was around the same time that he split with his longtime partner, composer Giancarlo Menotti. Barber published very little after that and died in 1981. Ever since, critics have been revising their opinions of his work, says Barbara Heyman.
I think he was more experimental than people give him credit for. He's not backward-looking, really. He just incorporated the elements that worked in his music from contemporary harmonic language.
Barber would sound great now. I think he actually, if he were coming into his own now, I think he probably wouldn't be receiving the criticism that he got when he was younger.
Jennifer Higdon is a composer and teacher at Barber's alma mater, the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Higdon is one of many younger composers who use traditional tonality in their music. She says they all owe a debt to Barber.
He had a lot of people who were saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. This isn't the advancement of music. And he did it, and he did it with such conviction and with such beauty that it's hard not to be convinced.
For all of his influence on younger composers like Higdon, Barber remained very much his own man.
I can only say that I myself wrote always as I wished, without a tremendous desire to find the latest thing possible.
In hindsight, the wisdom of that approach is hard to dispute. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
If you've been to Yellowstone National Park in recent years, you may have heard this. Those are gray wolves, specifically the wolves of the Druid Peak Pack. The Druids, as they're called, were the dominant pack in Yellowstone's Lamar Valley for more than a decade. Because their den was close to a main road, they became the most closely watched wolves in the park, and perhaps in the world. Researchers studied them day after day, gaining new information about wolf behavior. Last summer, there were 18 wolves in the pack, but since then, they've been decimated by disease and by competition from other wolves. Yellowstone biologist Doug Smith says the Druids are now down to just one wolf, and she's not doing well.
She's very, very thin. She's missing hair on about half of her body. She's moved out of Lamar Valley, so she's on the fringe now, and I just don't think she's going to make it.
What do you do in a situation like that? Do you leave her to the wild, or do you try to take her in and attempt to nurse her back to health?
Well, that's a great question, and it deals with the heart of what national parks are all about. We let nature take its course. This decline of the Druid pack and the state of this last female is all part of the natural scheme of things. So we allow nature to take its course.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the pack. What made them so special, and what it was that visitors to Yellowstone were able to see?
Well, most importantly, they were easy to see. I mean, if you came to Yellowstone during the Druid pack reign and spent a day or two looking, you'd see them. They had two leaders of the pack. We call them alphas. The male's number was 21. The female's is 42. They were a classic couple. People love to anthropomorphize about them. Geez, look how much they love each other, how they care for each other, how good mom and dad they are. I would go out some days, and there would be 300 or 400 people on the roadside just lapping this up. You know, real nature. We don't get anymore. And they provided it.
Filmmakers working in the park captured something pretty extraordinary back in 2003, this ritual as a new breeding male was welcomed into the pack. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the alpha male in Druid had been shot outside the park. This roaming male senses that there's a vacancy, but if you make a mistake, you're dead. So there was this sequence. It went on all day. A filmmaker was there. Part of my team was there. That they observed this kind of touch-and-go joining of the pack by an outside male, and that was 21, who went on to be that famous alpha wolf. He was hesitating and howling, and wolves from Druid would come out, typically the young females, and they were coming out and what we called play bowing for this male, and he was stiff and rigid, tail in the air, nervous, and he felt his way through it masterfully.
What other packs are you watching right now? Is there another pack that will replace the Druids?
There is. It's going to be, I think, another crowd favorite. The alpha female is lightly colored, and the nickname, the Silver Pack, came from her. They have slipped right in where the Druids used to be, and in fact, they killed a couple of the Druids. There's a new pack, we call them the Trio, two males and a female, at the far west end of the old Druid territory. They will likely have pups this year and be another pack. And then another pack at the far west end of Wolf Range called the Blacktail Pack is another pack that's being closely watched.
Doug Smith, thank you very much.
You bet.
Doug Smith is a wolf biologist and the leader of the Yellowstone Wolf Project.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Florida, the question of whether homosexuals should be allowed to adopt may soon be decided by the courts. Florida is the only state in the nation with an outright ban on gay adoptions. But in a series of recent decisions, courts have overruled the ban, saying it violates Florida's constitution. Now the issue is before a state appeals court, as NPR's Greg Allen reports.
At Martin Gill's home in Miami, it's a typical weekday afternoon. The kids are home from school, and he's picking up to make room for visitors.
Sometimes there's like three pairs of shoes from one kid in here. Like an hour before, they weren't here, and I'm like, okay.
This is the home of Martin Gill, his partner, and two brothers, 4 and 9 years old, whom they're seeking to adopt. The two boys have lived with the men for 5 years as foster children. For most of that time, the couple has been in court fighting for something Florida forbids gay couples, the right to adopt children. While we talk, Gil gives the kids some Play-Doh.
I can make a snowman.
Okay. Okay, you can talk, but I don't think you can talk that loud.
In court papers, the names of Gill's partner and the children have not been released for privacy reasons. By the time they begin taking care of the two brothers, Gill says he and his partner were experienced foster parents, taking care of six different children under license from the state's Department of Children and Families. They had planned to stop fostering children and move to Georgia, where they'd bought a home and where they hoped they might eventually adopt. But that plan changed. Shortly before Christmas in 2004, Gill got a phone call from a social worker asking him to take two brothers temporarily as foster children. At first, he said they couldn't because they'd soon be moving.
Basically, then she said, well, you could give these kids a great Christmas, and I'd hate to see them go to a shelter, that kind of thing. And I thought to myself, you know, we've got Christmas plans, but they're right here, and we're inviting family here. Certainly, we've got room for two more needy kids. And I said, okay. We said yes.
Gill says the boys were in bad shape, victims of neglect. Both had severe cases of ringworm. The baby, just 4 months old at the time, had a fever. Several months later, after a social worker told them the brothers would probably be separated and the older one likely not adopted, Gill and his partner went to court. A state judge ruled in their favor, finding that Florida's law banning gay adoption was not in the best interest of children and was unconstitutional. The ACLU has fought the law and lost twice. Gill's lawyer, Rob Rosenwald, says this case has succeeded so far because it focuses on one constitutional issue, that the law violates equal protection rights of both children and gay adopting parents.
The children, in that it permanently denies them the chance to have a permanent home with their gay caretaker, it violates the rights of the parents by treating them differently than their straight counterparts without any rational basis.
Along with this case, there are other signs that attitudes toward gay adoption are changing both in the courts and among the public. A recent Quinnipiac poll found a majority of Floridians now oppose the ban. And the Gill case is one of three in which state courts have overruled Florida law and approved gay adoptions. Even within state government, support of the law sometimes appears lukewarm. The State Department of Children and Families recently reversed itself and approved payment of health and education benefits to the adoptive son of a gay man. As to why it opposes adoption in the other cases, DCF spokesman Joe Follick says it's a matter of upholding the law.
Like every state agency, we are governed by the laws set by the legislature, approved by the governor, and if necessary, adjudicated by the courts. Until there is a unified appellate court decision on this issue, we are bound by Florida statute to defend and adhere to the law.
The issue is now before Florida's 3rd District Court of Appeals and is headed most likely to the state Supreme Court. Greg Allen, NPR News.